This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Türkiye is a golfer's paradise, and much of that is down to Belek on the country's southern Mediterranean coast. Courses here cut through lush pine forest, set on fast, sandy ground that's kept in immaculate condition all year round. And for those never quite ready to call it a day, Belek is also host to the first full 18-hole floodlit course in Europe. Local pro Dennis Sutmaz is lucky enough to call Belek her training ground.
There are more than 15 courses. You can play golf in winter and summer.
And once the round is done, long lunches replace scorecards and spas, hammams and slow afternoons take over.
When I'm not playing golf, I usually go to the beach, tan, go into the sea. You just feel like you're in another world.
Because in Belek, luxury isn't about excess. It's about time well spent. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It's the lab where we examine viral stories with the help of the top experts. And this week, the latest COVID variant has impacted the stock market almost before it has affected many humans. So where does Omicron fit into the mutating COVID story? Omicron, as much an expostulation as a COVID variant. We started with plain COVID, were upended by the Alpha variant, are still being smacked around by the Delta variant, and now are waiting for Omicron. So what are variants? How do they come about? How do some get to be so much more dangerous than others? What's this new one like? And when will we reach that happy stage when it's all just like a seasonal cold? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with a potted history of the variants of SARS-CoV-2, as this coronavirus is called, the one first recognised in Wuhan in China. Here's the Briefing Room's Ben Carter with the Alpha to Omicron of variants.
It sometimes seems hard to believe, but the first cases of COVID-19 were being reported only 2 years ago. The world has changed a lot in that time, and so has the virus. Viruses mutate, and COVID is no different, and that's led to variants, thousands of them. But a very small number of those have attracted the attention of scientists around the world.
The World Health Organization came up with a naming system for these. They look out for ones, along with the rest of the world, ones that may cause extra problems for us.
Michelle Roberts is the BBC's Health Online editor.
They're concerned about changes to the virus that could make it more easy to catch, more transmissible, or if it makes it more virulent or dangerous to us, if it causes even more severe infection than the original one that triggered the pandemic. Not every change or mutation is going to do that. So it's really quite difficult to know which ones to flag up and say, hey, we're worried about this one. So the system they have is variants of interest. So if they see some genetic changes and they think those are ones we need to watch, then other ones, if they become more concerning, become a variant of concern, as the name suggests.
In the early days of the pandemic, countries started naming the variants themselves.
We had the Kent variant because it had happened in the south of England. There was the South African variant. There was the Brazil one. The concern was that by labelling them in that way, it adds a bit of stigma. It sort of blamed the country that first identified it.
The 1918 flu pandemic was and is widely referred to as Spanish flu, even though there's nothing to suggest the virus originated there. It got that name simply because the pandemic broke out near the end of World War I and the news was censored in the country still fighting to maintain morale. Newspapers in Spain freely reported the outbreak, giving the impression that the country was the epicentre, hence the press outside Spain giving it the misnomer Spanish flu. Countries didn't want the same thing happening with COVID.
People were concerned that actually it might stop people reporting about it. And we really need to know when these things are cropping up to keep a good handle on them. So that was when the system came in. It took about 6 months to reach this decision, moving to Greek alphabet names.
Alpha, Vita, Gamma, Delta, Ypsilon, Zeta, Eta, Theta, Iota, Kappa, Lambda, Mi, Ni, Xi, Omicron.
We had Alpha, which was what was called the Kent variant originally, and that was spreading much more quickly than the version that started the pandemic. Then we had Beta as well, which was discovered in South Africa first. And there were concerns that it might have mutations that made it better at evading some of the immunity that was built up from either vaccines or past infection.
Then there was the Gamma variant that first appeared in Brazil in January of this year. But it was another variant appearing in India at roughly the same time that was of more concern.
Delta. And that quickly overtook Alpha. So it seemed to outcompete at the time and cause a lot more infections.
Experts estimate that Delta is between 40 to 60% more transmissible than Alpha and nearly twice as transmissible as the original virus first identified in China. That allowed it to outcompete other variants to become the dominant strain. Now it might face competition from Omicron.
When you look at the genetic blueprint of the virus, you can see there's a part called the spike protein that's on the surface of the virus, and it's the bit that helps it gain entry into our cells. The vaccines were designed around this spike. The original vaccines were based on original type of COVID that came out of Wuhan. So when there are big genetic changes to the spike, there's obviously a concern that the match is no longer as good. And that's what the concern is about Omicron at the moment, because it seems to be the most heavily mutated of all the variants that we've seen so far.
So far, we've talked about the most serious mutations, known as the variants of concern.
Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, Omicron.
But there is a lower category for mutations which are worth keeping an eye on. These are known as variants of interest.
Lambda, Mi.
Lambda first appeared in Peru in mid-2020, and it became the dominant strain in Argentina, Chile and Colombia this summer. But it hasn't travelled much outside of South America and accounts for less than 1% of all infections globally. There have been 8 reported cases of it in the UK. Then there's the Mi variant, first discovered in Colombia at the beginning of this year. Less easily transmissible than the Delta variant, and there have only been a few dozen cases in the UK. Omicron is the 15th letter in the Greek alphabet, and we've only mentioned the name of 7 variants. Why? Well, the World Health Organization updates its lists, hence the current variants of concern and interest. 6 variants have been assigned the names
Epsilon, Zeta, Eta, Theta, Iota, Kappa.
But scientists aren't too worried about those right now. You may have spotted that 2 other letters have been skipped to get to Omicron. It was decided that Ni, spelt N-U, would be too easily confused with the word new, and Xi, spelt XI, has, yes, you've guessed it, the same spelling as the Chinese president's surname, Xi. And that just wouldn't do.
Ben Carter speaking to Michelle Roberts. It's time to concentrate on the science of variants, discussed in such a way even I can understand it. Joining me in the briefing room are 3 eminent scientists. Emma Thompson is Professor of Infectious Diseases at Glasgow University's Centre for Virus Research. She's also the university's principal investigator for COG UK, the consortium which is sequencing the coronavirus genome worldwide. Dr. Geoffrey Barrett is director of the COVID-19 Genomics Initiative at the Wellcome Sanger Institute. And Dr. Charlotte Holcroft is a virologist from the University of Cambridge who specialises in the interactions between hosts, in this case that's us, and pathogens. Emma Thompson, we hear a lot about mutations and variants, so let's start from the beginning. What is a mutation and what is a variant, and what's the difference between the two of them?
Perhaps I might start with what a virus is first. So a virus is the most basic type of infectious pathogen, and it simply consists of protein and the genetic material that acts as a blueprint for the protein. So when the virus divides, the genetic material, or ribonucleic acid, RNA, must be copied. That RNA is made up of building blocks, which we attribute letters to, A, U, C, and G. And every time the virus divides, those must be copied. The virus does that quite inaccurately. This is a common phenomenon with all viruses, really, that they copy themselves inaccurately. And so when they make a mistake copying those letters, we call that a mutation. It's just a copy and paste error, if you like. A variant is a little bit different in that new variants are characterized by constellations of changes in the genome, so multiple mutations in the genome, which may alter the biology and the behavior of the virus.
Okay, so Geoffrey, why do viruses mutate and create variants? What's the benefit of it to them?
Well, most of the time, the mutations don't have any benefit at all. Most mutations don't change any of the virus's properties, and they're what we call neutral. They just kind of drift along. But very occasionally, a mutation might change some fundamental property of the virus in a way that's helpful to it. So, for example, they might make it easier to latch on to human cells and thereby to infect new people. They might make it faster at making new copies of itself, again, increasing the ability to infect additional people beyond that current host. Or they might make it less well neutralized by antibodies, for example, either those from vaccination or from a previous infection. And so when mutations like that happen, the evolutionary process known as natural selection will tend to push those to spread more widely and grow in frequency around the world. And variants, as we've come to call them, are usually when several such beneficial mutations come together in one virus that really give it such a substantial advantage compared to other circulating viruses that they spread and take off around the world in the way we've seen in several cases.
Charlotte, do different viruses mutate in different ways?
Yes, they do. Viruses are very variable between different types of virus. Some of them have genomes made out of RNA, ribose, nucleic acid, and some have genomes made up of a similar genetic material to us, DNA. And depending on whether the virus is made of RNA or DNA, that affects how fast it mutates. Whether it has one or two strands of that genetic material, that also affects how fast it mutates, basically because of how many mistakes it can make and how easily they're corrected. And then finally, the size of the virus's genetic code, so the length, the number of bases, also has an influence on how often it mutates. So coronaviruses are quite big for single-stranded RNA virus genomes. They've got about 30,000 letters in their genetic code. And so they have some proofreading ability compared to some other viruses, so they can check whether they're making mistakes in their genetic code. But there's not as much fidelity, not as much checking as in other viruses that we might be infected by.
Emma, does that mean that this particular coronavirus is more prone to mutation and creating variants than quite a lot of other viruses we've encountered?
Actually, I think when we first saw this virus, we thought that it might be less prone because it has a protein which allows it to correct errors when it replicates. And when we first started monitoring this virus, we've sequenced over 1 million genomes in the UK. We saw it mutating at quite a slow rate, perhaps one or two changes per month, as we might have expected. But then more recently, we've seen these sort of bolts from the blue, viruses arising very quickly with multiple changes. And the Omicron variant, for example, has around 50 changes when compared with the original virus, 30 of which are in that spike protein, which sits on the surface of the virus particle and is really important for sticking to human cells and also for recognition by our antibodies. So it's changed perhaps a bit more than we originally expected, and it seems to do it quite quickly.
Is this virus actually the same virus that was identified back in Wuhan in late 2019? Geoffrey?
Yes and no. It's, in one sense, moved not very far in the grand family tree of coronaviruses, which is the kind of big group that this virus belongs to. But it has changed in meaningful ways. And in particular, that spike protein, which is has the sort of starring role in the interaction between the virus and human cells, in this latest Omicron variant has changed really quite a lot. And in fact, it's further away than the original SARS-CoV-2 is from some other related viruses in the same family tree. So this is a pretty big, I think, adjustment in the virus's adaptation to humans.
Let's just go back to this question of comparison with other viruses. Do viruses like flu, HIV, chickenpox, do they compare with SARS-CoV-2 in the way in which they mutate?
You've named three very diverse kinds of virus in comparison to SARS-CoV-2. And so they will share some properties with the way that SARS-CoV-2 mutates, but not others. For example, influenza, flu. Each year you might hear people talking about H5N1 or H1N1. And that's describing different genes within the influenza genome. And what happens with influenza, it evades our immunity by swapping bits of RNA between strains. So it's swapping its genetic material when someone, some bird, some pig becomes infected with two different kinds of influenza at once. And it's that exchange of genetic material that allows new virus particles to emerge that are harder for the immune system to recognize. And so we get new influenza strains each year. HIV is incredibly error-prone, makes lots of mistakes when it replicates its small genome. It's one of its success strategies, and that's why we found it very difficult to design a vaccine against HIV. But then if we think about chickenpox, many people will be familiar with this. Chickenpox is made up of double-stranded DNA. So it's got a genome much more in its genetic material like our own genome. And so it's much less error-prone. And so chickenpox's strategy for success is not to mutate, but to infect the host for life. So after a child catches chickenpox, the virus then goes and hides within the nerves in the spine, and then it waits for that person to be immune compromised or very stressed or getting older and developing defects in their immune system, and then it pops back out when the immune system is not working as well.
And in the case of chickenpox, it pops back out as shingles, right?
Exactly.
I often, this programme, imagine that I'm the Home Secretary or the Health Secretary and ask for what I should understand and what I should do. I'd just like to ask you, Geoffrey, imagine I'm the virus for a moment. How would you advise me to now evolve for maximum evolutionary advantage?
Well, I feel a bit awkward giving the virus advice like this, but if I needed to, I think the thing which has changed the most in the last year, let's say, is the virus now needs to infect people with some degree of pre-existing immunity. So that's from both vaccines and from previous infections, both of which have been going on at a very high rate around the world in 2021. So in 2020, the virus might have had the best strategy to just infect one person to the next as fast as possible or as easily as possible, under the assumption that there were plenty of so-called naive hosts, that is, people with no pre-existing immunity from a vaccine or a previous infection. And because there are lots of them, that's the right strategy. But that isn't really such a good strategy anymore, because in the UK, for example, I think it's 90% plus of adults have antibodies against this virus now. So there are very few people, adults at least, with no antibodies, no previous immunity. So I think mutations that allow the virus to evade some of that immunity are the best strategy in the current situation.
Can we describe the way in which a new variant effectively achieves victory over an old dominant variant?
We talk about survival of the fittest in evolution. If you are a virus that can copy itself faster, if you are a virus that can cause your host to infect more people, then you are just going to outcompete all the other variants around you. And it's that problem with exponential growth, that if each person infected with Delta is infecting just one other person, but each person infected with Omicron were infecting, say, two other people, then the Omicron cases will grow twice as fast as the Delta cases.
Geoffrey, do you want to add to that?
Yes, I think what we saw when the UK, which was 100% alpha in the early part of 2021, got the vaccine coverage up high enough, The alpha variant went extinct. It was transmissible in a population without immunity, but basically could not compete in a population with lots of immunity. The delta variant, unfortunately, has, we think, both an advantage in transmissibility and some immune evasion. And that meant that it could start a new wave in the UK, even when alpha couldn't compete anymore. And the question for us now, which is whether Omicron has advantages in one or both of those areas.
With Omicron, do we think it has emerged from a population or from a single person with a condition?
Well, there's some evidence that new variants may emerge from individual patients. And the reason that we think that that might be happening is because the virus, when it moves just from person to person quite quickly, usually only infects people for a very short period of time. So you usually only have the virus for a small number of days in your body, and then the disease actually happens as a result of the immune response to the virus. But some people, there are a small percentage of the population who develop what we would call chronic or long-term infection with the virus. And those people tend to have immune deficiencies, particularly of B cells, which are very important for producing antibodies. And there was an important paper from colleagues at the University of Cambridge showing that there were changes seen, for example, in an individual patient who was, had a long-term infection, some of which had been seen in the alpha variant of the virus. And so theoretically, we think that it may be more likely that new variants actually emerge in individual patients who have weak immune systems, and that allows the virus to adapt to an individual person much more quickly. So it is possible that it may have emerged in a single individual. We don't have direct evidence for that yet, but we have some suggestive evidence.
But that wouldn't take away from the point that the wider the proliferation, the more likely it is to happen.
Certainly not. And so obviously, if there's very widespread transmission, then people who are immunosuppressed in the community, and there always are these people, then they are more likely to become infected, and the virus may adapt from person to person as well.
Charlotte, one of the things that's puzzled me, or that's intrigued me all the way through since the beginning of the pandemic in discussion about how the virus and its variants develop, is whether or not the advantage to the virus lies in being not particularly harmful, but very transmissible. And therefore, in a sense, that kind of gave a sense of security, which was as a particular variant became more dominant, it would be more likely to be less harmful. Does that hold?
It's not a guarantee by any means. One thing I would say about the difference between SARS-CoV-2, COVID, and the original SARS caused by SARS-CoV-1 is that with SARS-1 in the early 2000s, there was a tendency for people to become more infectious as they became more ill. So they're starting to become symptomatic, they feel very poorly, and then they're at their maximum point of infectiousness. And one of the real differences with SARS-CoV-2, COVID, is that you are very infectious right at the beginning of your symptoms and just at the onset of symptoms, 24 hours, 48 hours before you become ill. So you're not feeling poorly, you're not staying at home, you're perhaps going out and socializing and spreading it to people around you. And then gradually you become more and more unwell if you're going to develop a symptomatic infection. And by the point at which you're perhaps needing hospital care, you might be past your infectious period. And so then the virus is under no evolutionary pressure not to make the host ill, because it's achieving its transmission point before the damage is done. So that's one of the big differences between the original SARS and this SARS-CoV-2 virus. And then if we think about a little bit of data that we have from smallpox, obviously a massive human threat, there is a little bit of evidence that between the sort of age of Viking exploration and the 18th, 19th, early 20th century, actually smallpox may have become more deadly and may have picked up more and more mutations that made it better at evading the human immune system and that might actually have increased the burden of disease. So SARS-CoV-2 may become milder, it may become more like the seasonal coronaviruses that cause coughs and colds, but that could take 50 to 100 years, and that is the gradual timescales over which evolution happens for an RNA virus.
I was thinking more in terms of 4 or 5 years. I think the government was hoping more in terms of 4 or 5 years, and we all were. Geoffrey Barrett, let's look at the circumstances under which you make it suboptimal for a viral variant and a very bad viral variant to be created. There's been a lot of discussion that the main thing that you need to do is to vaccinate as many people around the world as you possibly can, as quickly as you possibly can, because the more people are infected, the more variants you get. And then there's also the question about whether or not a certain level of vaccination actually helps a virus to mutate to escape the vaccine. Can you take me through that one?
Yes. So first of all, just to emphasize your opening point, which is that the most dangerous thing for humans is letting the virus have lots of opportunities to mutate, because some of those will turn out to be variants that we don't want to cope with. So reducing the total number of infections, the total number of transmissions, is by far the best thing we can do. There is some debate about whether there's a kind of balance point at which some amount of immunity in a given place is the most kind of likely to promote variants. That is, if you roll all the way back to early 2020, when nowhere in the world had any immunity, that means the virus might have the strongest pressure just to select mutations that make it transmit from one person to the next as efficiently as possible. But then if you roll forward to a situation where everyone is fully vaccinated, boosted, et cetera, then it's just very hard for the virus to infect anybody. And so even though at that point, the immune pressure is probably selecting for mutations that help it evade that immunity, it doesn't have many opportunities. And it may be the case that there is a kind of middle ground when there's enough immunity to provide the pressure, but not enough to completely close off the virus's route of evolution. Whether that is true or not is an open question, but there's a few pieces of evidence that suggest it's not a massive issue. Essentially, all of the variants that we've seen that have become global variants of concern, so alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and omicron, they don't obviously come from that situation of being from communities with an intermediate level of immunity. So I think the evidence is at best marginal that that's really a sort of critical factor in the evolution of these variants.
In other words, the prudent thing to do would be to vaccinate as many people as possible. I mean, is that broadly right, Emma?
Well, halting transmission is something that we really need to try to do, because as the virus transmits from one person to the next, then it accumulates mutations, and those mutations may result in both changes in the biology of the virus to allow it to adapt better to the human cells that it lives in, and also to allow it to evade the immune system. So we know from experiments that we've done in the laboratory that as long as you can get quite high levels of what we call neutralization, so neutralization means the prevention of the virus getting into human cells, and that's by antibodies, the higher the levels that you can achieve through vaccination, the more likely you are to have protection from these new variants. So we know that neutralization responses are lower with many of these new variants, and we know that giving boosters really gives a very large rise in neutralization responses, both to the Wuhan variant, which is what the vaccines produce, and also the other new variants. But we don't know yet how well boosting will help us against Omicron, but by process of understanding, as these other new variants have evolved, we know that the higher your neutralization response, the better.
Now, one of the things that has characterized the last week has been broadcasters asking scientists to say how bad Omicron is, and scientists saying, we don't know yet. Have we got any advance on that, Geoffrey?
It is a situation where I think nobody wants to hear the real answer, which is it's going to take time to understand this in a careful way. And there are lots of off-the-cuff statements being made, some of which have moved the stock markets by billions and billions of dollars. So I do think, even though we all are desperate for the information, right now, as we're recording this, the answer is we just don't know.
I can add...
Sorry, Emma.
Well, I can add that at least two laboratories in the UK now likely have the virus in their hands, although we have to be able to culture it to grow it up to levels that are sufficient to test serum responses. So I actually delivered some virus to our centre, the MRC Centre for Virus Research, this morning. but it does take time to culture the virus to adequate levels, then to share that with other laboratories, and then to test serum, which comes from people who are vaccinated. And so I think we will have some answers in the coming days and week to 2 weeks, but we will just have to wait for that information to emerge.
Emma Thompson there with Charlotte Holcroft and Geoffrey Barrett. My conclusion is that there's no easy good news on the COVID science front. It may be decades before a dominant variant exists that is as domesticated as the common cold. In the meantime, jab everything that moves. My thanks to Emma Thompson, Geoffrey Barrett, Charlotte Holcroft, Michelle Roberts and Ben Carter. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Ben Carter and Kirsty Knight. The sound engineer was Graham Puddyfoot and the editor is Richard Varden. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've explored Europe's surging COVID levels, China's economic woes, the state of British rivers and the Afghan refugee crisis.
Hello, I'm Professor Steven Pinker. We all want to reason more clearly and to make better choices about everything from life and love to medicine and money. But even the best of us get things wrong.
I would have twice as many billions if I just made a different decision.
I mean, of course, one can always learn from other people's mistakes.
It's ideal to do that.
Each episode is a conversation with an expert on rationality and someone who deals with our corresponding irrationality in real life.
Rarely do we sort of walk around living out probabilities. Oh my God, wait, 90% prevalence. It's hard to sort of hold on to that in real life.
I hope you'll join us as we try to make sense of making sense and hopefully to make better decisions. That's Think with Pinker from BBC Radio 4. Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.